This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As White House press secretary during the first 2.5 years of George W. Bush's presidency, my guest Ari Fleischer delivered daily briefings at which he responded to reporters' questions. Fleischer is handling questions from the press again, but this time it's part of his book tour. He's just published a memoir called Taking Heat, The President, The Press, and My Years in the White House. He joined the Bush team in 1999 during the presidential campaign. He previously worked as communications director for Elizabeth Dole, press secretary for Pete Domenici, and spokesman for the House Ways and Means Committee. Fleischer says his new book explains why he did his job the way he did, particularly during a time of war. I bet when you took the job as White House press secretary, you weren't expecting to become a wartime press secretary. Where were you when you first heard on September 11th that the first plane had crashed into the tower of the World Trade Center?
I was with the president. I traveled with him just about everywhere he went. And so I was in the motorcade. We were just getting out of a school and out of the motorcade to go to a school event in Sarasota, Florida. And I was literally about five cars behind the president's limo. And I got a page telling me the first tower had been hit.
Was there any talk about possibly calling off the event at that point?
Zero. Because at that moment, we all thought it had to be some type of terrible accident. The president didn't know what the weather was in Manhattan on that day. He was in Florida, but his first thought was it must have been a pilot error in bad weather that he just flew off course. We didn't know at that moment that it was a large commercial aircraft. So no, the event started. And in fact, plans were made for the president in that small schoolroom to address the press pool that was gathered there to say that federal resources will be made available, we're going to help New York deal with this problem, thinking it was an accident.
How'd you hear about the second plane?
Second plane, I got another page halfway through that event where the president was participating in a reading event with the little children, and it said the second tower's been hit. And I knew instantly that it had to be terrorism. And moments later, Andy Card walked into the room. I was about 10 feet on the left of the president. Andy Card walked into the room and whispered in the president's ear that the second tower has been hit. America's under attack.
So many Americans are surprised, confused by the fact that the president stayed in his chair,
right,
and kept listening to the children read after hearing that America was under attack. What you did actually was write a sign and hold it up to the president.
Correct.
What did the sign say?
I wrote a sign on the back of a notepad that said, "Don't say anything yet." Because I thought until the president can get a proper briefing, he should not say what he was planning on saying before, because now this is not an accident. This must be terrorism. And the first words that the American people get from the president shouldn't be something where he is not yet armed with information. And I was very surprised that none of the press shouted questions at him as they were let out of the room. Either they didn't know the second tower was hit, or they were too numb to ask questions. And from my experience, the White House press corps is never too numb.
So was it you and Andrew Card, or was it the president himself who decided just stay where you are, pretend like nothing's happening, keep listening to the children read?
Well, no, what the president decides, we were going to cancel the event, so he left the smaller schoolroom.
Wait, but he sat in the chair for
okay.
For
he sat
like
in the chair for
several
minutes.
Yeah.
I think it was seven.
Well, so whose decision was that?
That's the president's.
That's the president's decision.
And he whispered in his ear, and nobody else was talking to him from that moment. He stayed there. And I know that a lot of
Andy Card didn't say, second tower has hit, we're under attack, don't move.
No, Andy Card said just what I said. He said that's what Andy told everybody. So the president was sitting there, and a lot of controversy was made, especially by Michael Moore and Fahrenheit 911, about the president just sitting there. And I think, frankly, Terry, that was some of the most unfair criticism, particularly the way it was done in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it showed a little scary music, and splicing can make almost anybody look bad. Nothing would have changed if he did bolt from his chair and leave, other than if he had gotten up from that chair looking scared or spooked. I think it would have scared and spooked the nation. He remained calm, left the room. Now, in those 7 minutes, it allowed people to figure out what was happening to the best degree we could, but still no one knew about the other two aircraft, or if they did, no one had passed that on to anybody who was in a position to pass it on to the president. And so still we thought it was those two aircraft only. So even 7 minutes later, we're in the holding room right next to the little schoolroom, classroom, and the president's working the phones, Andy Carter's working the phones, and an official from the National Security Council who always traveled with us is working the phones, trying to figure out what's going on. Not a word about the other two aircraft, not a word about them being hijacked. I don't know off the top of my head if they had been hijacked yet at that very moment. And then the president made the decision that we were going to leave to go back to Washington. He left then to go address a larger group that he was supposed to give a big speech to. and said in a speech that several people said he looked nervous. And he said in that speech that he's going to leave, return to Washington, the nation's been attacked. And you hear a lot of shock in the room. People didn't know it. And at that point, we headed back into the motorcade to go to Air Force One, presumably for Washington at that moment.
But is what you're saying that the president was basically irrelevant in the first few minutes after the second attack, that the president could afford to not be in the loop, that other people were working the phones and the president didn't matter, he could just stay listening? I mean,
well, no, actually, the president, too, was working the phones. If I didn't say that, I'm
mistaken. Well, no, not during the minutes he was in the chair, which is the minutes we're talking about.
Well, clearly not in those minutes that he was in the chair. But keep in mind also, the president is not the finder of facts. The finders of facts are more aligned, I put it, the colonels and lieutenant colonels who work at the National Security Council and at the Department of Defense or the Federal Aviation Administration. Those are the people who are on the front lines, who are in communication with what's happening on the ground. And that information then filters up to the president through either his national security advisor, Andy Card, or wherever it comes from.
But in a situation where every second counts, as we well learned that day, why wouldn't the president want to immediately get to a secure phone so he could immediately, or as soon as he's ready or needed, be on the phone with whoever on his staff or in the military he needs to?
Well, it was just the president's judgment that he stayed in that chair, and he didn't talk to anybody about it. He just stayed there, and I think showed a picture of calm to the country, which later was shown as the people looked at that clip, and then he got up. But my point
let's say
he just got up from the chair immediately after Andy said what he said. It wouldn't have changed anything. It wouldn't have changed the course of history. I don't think there was anything he would have learned then that he didn't learn 7 minutes later. There was nothing he would have learned earlier that would have changed events. I think that was the fact of what happened on September 11th and the sequence in which it happened.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ari Fleischer, and he was President Bush's White House press secretary for the first 2.5 years of the Bush administration. Now he's written a memoir called Taking Heat, The President, the Press, and My Years in the White House. How did the war affect your interactions with reporters during your White House briefings? I mean, once the terrorists are attacking, then everybody's wanting to know, what are we doing about it? What's the military doing? Of course, a lot of this stuff is going to be secret, and it's your job to make sure it stays secret. So, like, you always have a dual role when you're White House press
Correct.
Secretary. You give information and you hold back information.
Exactly right.
During war, was there more to hold back than
sure
to give?
Sure was. And September 11th led to a change in my relationship with the White House press corps. By that I mean my professional relationship. On a personal level, I like a lot of those people, virtually every single one of them, and we got along pretty well. But on a professional level, it created a lot more tension and led to a more splenetic relationship. And that's because reporters are trained to break the next big story. They are trained to ask the hardest, toughest questions and find out what is the government going to do. At the same token, what the government was going to do was military. And so reporters would literally ask me, there's a chapter in the book called You'll Attack When? And I simply reprint many of my briefings with the press where I was literally asked on September 15th, I was asked, will you use nuclear weapons in Afghanistan? I was asked to confirm whether or not we had moved fighter aircraft to Pakistan a couple weeks later. Terry, those are questions that no press secretary should answer, and I wouldn't answer them. And it did lead to more tension in the briefing room because reporters thought I was secretive and tight-lipped, and they were right.
During the lead-up of the invasion of Iraq, you were asked a lot about weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
And one of the things you said, March 21st, 2003, well, there is no question that we have evidence and information that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, biological and chemical. All this will be made clear in the course of the operation for whatever duration it takes.
Yeah, and that sure is what we all thought, and it sure looks like it turned out to be wrong. We all did believe that, and I said it earnestly. It was the considered best judgment of the intelligence analysts in the government. It had been so for about 10 years. President Clinton had said it earlier. Vice President Gore had said it. Senator Kerry, interestingly, said it in a speech on the Senate floor in 2002. And it looks like we may all have been wrong about it. But when you get to the big picture, should we still have gone to war? I happen to believe that we also found, that's not I believe, but I know we also found the weapons inspectors who declared that we may all have been wrong, David Kay and Charles Dulfer. They reported that in 2003, Iraq was still hiding from the weapons inspectors right before the war began an ongoing research and development of biological and chemical weapons concealed in scientists' homes. And they said he was 6 months away from being able to develop mustard agent and 2 years away from being able to develop nerve agent in significant quantities. We never found the stockpiles that we were all certain that we would find. And remember, George Tenet said to the president, it's a slam dunk, the head of the CIA. So we may have been wrong about that, but we weren't wrong about his intentions.
Do you feel that you participated in what some critics have called the hyping of weapons of mass destruction?
Absolutely
to
not.
Generate more support for going into Iraq?
Absolutely not. The job of the press secretary is to faithfully articulate what the government is doing and why it's doing it at the time it's doing it. And all you can do is work off of the best information available at the time. And that is loyally what I did. I articulated accurately what we thought and what we knew at the time. Now, I wish we could figure out what went wrong. I think that's what we need to do now. And there is a commission doing that, but why were we wrong? And what does it say about Iran and North Korea? Are we overestimating or underestimating those nations? That, to me, is the lesson that has to be learned from the mistakes we made.
Let me ask you about one of the many tough moments you had at a briefing. This was February 22nd, 2003. You were asked about the, you know, if President Bush was going to, like, make deals to get more allies on our side as we went to war with Iraq. And you were asked specifically if Mexico was being given special deals on immigration agreements like amnesty for guest workers or things along those lines. So if we were cutting a deal with Mexico to get their support, and you said, you're saying that leaders of other nations are buyable, and that is not an acceptable position. And then the press corps laughed.
Right.
I think they laughed because
they think
deals
are
always made.
Viable.
But, well, that people cut deals. What was your reaction when they laughed?
Well, I think it's a good example of, in that case, where I think the skepticism goes too far. You know, the issue here is, well, could we get Mexico's vote on a second resolution at the Security Council to authorize war? And we couldn't. Mexico would not have voted for us. We pulled the vote before anybody knew, but we knew Mexico was going to vote no. And I think it shows that I was accurate, that leaders are not viable. Now, there are all kinds of things, I think, below the level of a Security Council resolution authorizing war, where you do reach agreements with nations over policies and trade and compromises, but not on a fundamental principle of will you support a war or not. And that was the point I was making.
Was that an embarrassing or an awkward moment for you, or did you just think, well, another day, another White House briefing?
Another day, another White House briefing. You have to have thick skin to do the job that I used to do, and it comes with a territory. And you also have to realize it's not personal. The White House press corps is plenty sharp, plenty tough, plenty capable, and plenty skeptical. Sometimes I think too skeptical, but it's the way Washington can be.
What's one of your most unfavorite moments that you'd be willing to share?
Well, I think probably the biggest mistake I ever made in that briefing room was a couple months earlier when reporters were talking about the cost of going to war with Iraq, and I was asked how much it would cost, and we didn't have any reliable estimates, and I said the cost of a one-way ticket if Saddam were to leave would be less than, you know, $100 billion cost, whatever the cost of war would have been. And then I had it, somehow I said this, that and the cost of would be even less than a one-way ticket. The cost of one bullet would be even less than that if the Iraqi people took it on themselves. And all of a sudden, all the White House reporters sat up and, are you advocating assassination? Is that the policy of the United States government? And I spent the entire afternoon calling reporters back. I went right into the Oval Office afterwards and turned myself into the president. And he said, you better fix that. That's not our policy. And I spent the afternoon calling reporters to say that what I said is not the Americans, the president's policy.
What inspired you to say it?
You know, there's just a tendency when you're in that room to either be so buttoned down that you never say anything wrong, or sometimes you just try to put out just a little extra, a little something to change the tone of the briefing. And in that case, I just went too far. I just said something trying to be a little cute that really was wrong policy, number one, and was foolish, number two, frankly.
The White House press corps, many of the members of the White House press corps have been very critical of the Bush administration's tight control over information and its steadfastness in staying on point, on message. A couple of quotes. David Gregory of NBC, my biggest frustration is that this White House has chosen an approach with the White House press corps, generally speaking, to engage us as little as possible. Elizabeth Buemiller of the New York Times, too often they treat us with contempt. In comparison, the Reagan administration coddled us. This crowd has a wall up. They never get off their talking points. Legitimate complaints?
Well, I don't think so. I think what really there is frustration in the press about the way the Bush administration deals with the press. But I think most of it stems from the fact that the press, again, are trained to break the next big story and that they break the news first before the president does. The president said to me and to others in the White House, he thinks his job is to make the news, and he doesn't want to read about it in the newspapers or see it on TV before he himself publicly says it. This president is surrounded by people who don't go out of a closed meeting, give reporters tips, and say, here's what the president is about to do in 2 hours. I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to give it to you. We try to treat all the press the same way, treat them fair, make the news at the same time, and the president is the one who wants to make the news. And that can be frustrating for reporters.
Well, I think they also want more than the official press release. They want to know what people are really saying and thinking, what's going on. And I think that the complaint here was that information, the control of information, is really tight.
But I think they still get that. I mean, everybody knew that Colin Powell had initially had objections about the war in Iraq. That really came through. People saw the Arab-Israeli matters. The state had a different view than perhaps the vice president and others. It still gets out there. The 20 years I've been in business, reporters have always had levels of complaints about government and government information. In fact, in President Bush's father's administration, nobody could keep any news quiet. Everything was given to the press. One faction would fight against another faction, and the press absolutely loved it. That's how they get a lot of good insider tips. And then they write stories that said White House in disarray. You don't get any stories about a White House that say White House in array. Instead, you get the flip side of it is the White House is secretive. And I think it's part of the thesis of my book that the press is always going to find something to cover that's conflict-oriented, but they are seldom to give praise.
Dana Milbank of The Washington Post, and he covers the White House for The Washington Post, he said the administration speaks with one voice because officials have, quote, talking points that they email to friends and everyone says exactly the same thing. You go through the effort of getting Karl Rove on the phone and he'll say exactly the same thing as Scott McClellan. Legit?
Well, our job is to say what the president thinks. And unless the president happens to think two things at one time, which he typically doesn't, like him or don't like him, he takes pretty clear stands and the staff knows it. And so I don't think it should surprise people if the people in the White House are saying the same thing. Now, if one faction in the White House is fighting another faction in the White House to influence the president, that's how reporters used to get different competing stories, and they loved it. But that's not the case in this White House. You really, even when you're fighting, even when factions go at each other, they keep it inside the walls of the Oval Office so the president can hear both sides, but then make a deliberative decision.
Dana Milbank was talking about being frustrated because everybody's on the same talking points. How do those talking points get spread around?
Well, frankly, it wasn't talking points for me. It was being in the meetings with the president.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the same meetings as Carl or Karen Hughes or the head of Congressional Affairs or the head of the Office of Management and Budget. We would sit in the same meeting. Let me give you a couple of one example. The president was talking about war in Iraq and the price that we're paying when we lose servicemen and servicewomen every day and the toll it was taking and how hard it is to make the decision to go to war. And he said, I'm the one who has to hug the widows and the widowers, because you would go to military bases and have to do that. Well, a lot of us all started talking about, you know, this is a difficult decision. The president's the one who has to hug the widows and the widowers. None of us needed talking points. We were in the meeting and we heard the president say it. So on the one hand, I think it's part of the skepticism and sometimes cynicism of the press corps that they dismiss this as talking points. It also very well may be that they are getting an accurate and full portrayal from the people who heard it directly firsthand from the president, who are serving history and serving the public by passing it on.
You know how President Bush sometimes misspeaks a little bit?
I've noticed.
Right. Well, one of those, I think, was about the story you're talking about. I'm not going to remember the quote offhand, but in talking about how he needs to, like, hug the widows and hug the family, he made a little bit of a gaffe in the way he said it. I don't know if you remember this quote, and I wish I had a better memory and could quote it to you. But I was wondering if it becomes your job on occasions where there is a little bit of a gaffe to fix it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, in fact, I remember once, this was June of 2003, and the president was in the Roosevelt Room, and he was asked a question. This is the aftermath of the war, and now the guerrilla attacks and the frequency of the soldiers dying start to increase. And he was asked a question about all the attacks on our troops. And he said, my message to those who want to attack our troops is bring it on. And as we walked back in the Oval Office, I said to him, Mr. President, think of how that sounds to a mother who's got a child fighting for us over there. I mean, bring it on. And he said to me that all he meant to say was he has so much faith in our military that if anybody wants to attack us, that bring it on, our military is the best, and anybody who attacks us is probably going to lose their life. I said, but it didn't come across that way, sir. And I think he got it instantly. My job was to say to the president, it was easy to do, Mr. President, I would do it this way or that way, and to help correct him in private. It didn't mean that I would go out to the press and say, boy, did he screw up. Let me tell you what he just did. Sometimes a good advisor is a good advisor on the inside, and a good president is a president who will listen.
Bennett Roth of the Houston Chronicle told Jake Tapper, when Tapper was writing for Salon magazine, that he had pointed out that the president had encouraged parents to speak to their children about drug abuse in an attempt to stop their children from using drugs. And so Bennett Roth said to you at a briefing, how much has the president talked to his own daughters about both drugs and drinking? And given the fact that his own daughter was cited for drinking, isn't that a sign that there's only so much effect that parents can have on their children's behavior? And he says that you asked him to respect the president's privacy and that you later called him and told him that his question had been, quote, noted in the building.
Yeah, that was a bad choice of words on my part. What I wanted to say to him was the president, and this came from the president because I knew the president wanted to treat it as a private family matter when his then 20-year-old daughter was cited for underage drinking. And I think that's what every family would want to do, probably what every family does. And saying noted in the building was just a bad choice of words. I should have just said to him, listen, the president didn't appreciate your question. But again, it's reporters' right to ask whatever they want to ask. But on a question like that, I think I was proper in drawing a zone of privacy and saying this is between the president and his daughters.
But he wasn't, I mean, you could argue that he wasn't asking anything private. He was just referring to something that had already been reported in the news, and that his point was, does the president's policy, does the president's approach jive with reality? Does it even jive with the reality of his own family? So, I mean, that's, I'm not sure. Is that invading his privacy?
The question was about what did the president say to his daughters. The question did ask what did the president say to his daughters, as I recall it. And
that's not in the quote I have, but you may be right.
Is that from the briefing itself, or is that from a story?
This is a quote from the briefing, as far as I know.
Okay. As I remember the briefing, it was a question about what message did the president give his daughters. But even allowing for a second part of that question, which is, and what does that say about the efficacy of a parent talking to a child? In the context of big, glaring stories and headlines, which were earned because his daughters did get cited, one of his daughters got cited, it's impossible to address that issue without, again, bringing the daughters back into play. And I did not think it was my job to talk about the daughters and the family and any of the problems that they may have had. And I respected the press when they drew a real line around Chelsea Clinton and honored her privacy. And I think the press corps was pretty good about doing that with the Bush daughters, except when the Bush daughters did things that were newsworthy. But I really tried to keep that zone of privacy. And I think the way I said it to Bennett was an awkward way to say it. I should have just said it easily and straightforward. The president himself didn't appreciate it. Because I thought he should know that. Now, that's not said to a reporter to make a reporter not ask questions or to intimidate, but it's because I think reporters should know that there still are sensitive privacy zones, even for people who are the president.
You write in your book that you think the media basically has a liberal bias. You write, the press are largely democratic, and that fact shows up in their work more often than most reporters like to acknowledge. What's an example of that?
Well, let me tell you a couple things, if I can. First, I wrote in the book and put it very prominently on the back that we are a better, stronger country because the press get 1,000 facts right every day. And then I said, within that context, my two beefs with the press are, one, I think they are biased in favor of conflict. Secondarily, that there is a subtle ideological bias, particularly on policy issues, and especially on social policy issues where it's easier to be a Democrat than a Republican. Here's a perfect example. When President Bush issued an executive order on his first business day saying that family planning groups that counsel abortions overseas can no longer receive tax dollars, Bill Clinton on his first working day issued the exact same executive order, except these groups could receive tax dollars for family planning. Dan Rather on the Evening News in 1993, when Bill Clinton did it, said that Bill Clinton honored a campaign promise today. 8 years later, when George W. Bush took the mirror action and said they could not get the money, he didn't say that he honored a campaign promise, even though it was one. He said that President Bush today quickly appealed to the right flank of the Republican Party. To me, that's a perfect example. ABC did the same thing. Peter Jennings in 1993 said Honor to Promise. 2001, their correspondent said that he was pandering to, he didn't use the word pander, but again, put in a political context about appealing to the right-wing base of the Republican Party. To me, that's a classic example of a subtle, not so subtle, bias on social policy. Why is the pro-choice action labeled as honorary campaign promise? If you honor a promise, that's meritorious no matter what. But pandering to a political base or appealing to a flank of a party makes it sound like it's a political action. I think that was a classic example.
So in your opinion, do the three broadcast TV networks have a bias in their news?
Well, the way I put it is it's subtle, because I think reporters really do work very hard and earnestly to cover the facts exactly straight and say what the government does. But it's a labeling issue. Very often the conservative side is labeled as conservative when the liberal side isn't labeled as liberal. Very often you hear the words right-wing thrown around in the press. You seldom hear left-wing. Tom DeLay is a right-wing congressman. You very seldom hear Ted Kennedy is a left-wing Democrat. The labels are just different. Protesters, when the protests took place against Mrs. Clinton's health care reform proposal when she was the first lady, most of the stories read conservative protester gathered to protest Mrs. Clinton. When President Bush would travel and get met by protesters at the sides of the roads, they never said liberal protesters. It was activists. The labeling seems to be different. The words are different. A summary of President Bush's tax cut in 2003 that aired on ABC summed it up by saying it's classic trickle-down economics. That was the ABC correspondent who said that. Trickle-down economics was a term used in an ad by Walter Mondale against Ronald Reagan's tax cuts. It's a derisive way to summarize tax cuts. These are the subtleties I saw. And the reason I call it subtle is because the press doesn't change the facts. They don't misreport the facts. It's just these labeling issues and how issues quickly get summarized that it seemed to me lean in favor of one party and not with the other. And it's compounded because a story in the New York Times pointed out last summer, by 12 to 1, reporters from within the Beltway thought John Kerry would be a better president than George W. Bush. And that same story said that surveys show that 80% of reporters vote Democratic. And I don't think it's malice. I just think it's human nature. It seeps through, no matter how professional a reporter is and trying to stay right down the middle. Give me a newsroom that has 80% Republican voters, and I think you'll see the opposite take place. You'll see a lean to the other side, not out of malice, but again, it's just human nature.
What do you think of Fox News coverage? Do you think that they're fair, that they're neutral, or...
No, I think Fox is conservative. And I think if Fox is perceived as conservative, the networks need to grapple with the fact that they're perceived as liberal. And I think one of the reasons Fox is just doing so well and is growing so much in a field where most media organizations are shrinking is because there's a lot of dissatisfaction among people center-center-right with the media.
Can I point out a kind of obvious difference between Fox News and, you know, if you're equating that, you know, network news is liberal and Fox is conservative, let's just call a spade a spade. I mean, on Fox News, O'Reilly starts and ends each show with an editorial. On Fox News, Sean Hannity and Alan Combs, their job is to give their opinions.
Yeah,
as they talk,
I don't include those nighttime shows in that. I think more about the 6 o'clock news with Brit Hume, which is their equivalent to the 6:30 news with the anchors, because nighttime cable TV is all opinion. I mean, you can go to CNN, you can go to, CNN's less so, in the sense they don't have the provocateurs on the way Fox does and some of the others, MSNBC does. Nighttime cable, Crossfire on Fox, they really have gone to that format, and that's just opinion TV.
I've heard that Fox was like the favored network within the White House when they were watching TV.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
Why is it?
Well, because I think that Fox doesn't repeat those mistakes that I was just describing, where one side is declared right-wing and the other side is not given a label. I think Fox is conscious of that. They probably lean on the other side of it, too. But there are also stories on Fox that lead Fox that aren't on the other shows involving controversies that Democrats get into. Senator Byrd's floor speech about acquitting President Bush's judicial nominee tactics of how he's going to promote his nominees with Adolf Hitler. I don't know if that was covered on the network news. I didn't track it. But that was a lead story on Fox, for example.
Now, we recently learned about several journalists who were being paid by the Bush administration, including Armstrong Williams. His company was paid to do ads promoting No Child Left Behind, but he was also paid to promote it himself.
And that's a mistake, unless you reveal it. That has to be publicly disclosed.
Do you think it would be ever be acceptable for a journalist to take money to express an opinion?
If it's his opinion also already, I think in the case of Armstrong Williams, I can't imagine he was anywhere other than on the side he came out on school choice. But I think it would be wrong if somebody got money and changed their opinion. But if he was always for school choice and then somebody said, we're going to give you a contract to help get that message out, I think as long as you disclose that and you say, this is Armstrong Williams and I'm giving you a message on behalf of the Department of Education, on behalf of school choice, then it's consistent with your philosophy. You should be personally comfortable with it, and it's publicly disclosed. That I wouldn't have a problem with. But generally, the government should not be paying journalists. Columnists are in a little bit of a different category. But journalists should not be paid by the government. Draw a straight line.
Okay, so we had Armstrong Williams getting paid. Then Karen Ryan and Albert Garcia were paid to appear in stage reports promoting the president's Medicare prescription drug plan. But those reports were packaged.
Packaged
were like real reports, but they were actual promotion spots. And then there was also two syndicated columnists who were paid by the Department of Health and Human Services to promote the administration's marriage initiatives. And I think some people are concerned, okay, the Bush administration, yourself included, criticizes the press for being liberal. Is this what they want the press to be, people who are, you know, paid to promote their message?
No, I disagree with paying reporters to promote a message. And that's a line that should be drawn and it shouldn't be violated. As far as the package news where people look like reporters and they're kind of giving a report, that's been standard fare of public relations agencies for probably 10 to 15 years now. It's been going on a long time. I think if people want to object to that practice, I would have no problems with that. I also think most people see through this kind of stuff. Most people can tell if it's something that is packaged in opinion or if it's something that they think is a bona fide news report.
How much of this happened on your watch?
Well, I guess the Armstrong-Williams thing, I don't know what years it was happening. I didn't know anything about it until I heard about it in the press.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know when it began.
How do you think this has affected the Bush administration's credibility with the press and the public?
Well, I think less so with the press. I think that it's given reason for a lot of liberal voters and people who are critics of the president to say that this is an administration that's trying to manage the news. I recognize that there's an appearance problem here, and they have to clean that up. And the agencies have to be on the lookout not to give these type of contracts out to people. But there's nothing I knew that I ever knew about any of that emanating from the White House.
Let's get to James Guckert, a.k.a.
Yes.
Jeff Gannon. Okay, now, he worked for a conservative website, GOP USA, or
right.
Talon News. He sometimes asked questions that were included strong statements in praise of the administration. I've read that some of what he published on his website was actually taken straight from Republican fact sheets. He came to the White House under an alias. He was associated with pornographic websites, worked as a male escort, and kept on as a White House correspondent with day passes, day
right.
after day. He started
while I was the
press secretary.
Correct.
What did you make of him?
Well, when I found out that he worked for something called GOP USA, I stopped calling on him because I also draw a line that says there should be a lot of latitude in determining who is a reporter. I think you have to be flexible on that. Otherwise, there's a real risk that government is saying no to people who are bona fide reporters. But I draw the line that if somebody works for a political party, then they are not a reporter. They're an advocate for the party. So I stopped calling on him. He had his boss call me, and his boss assured me that the name GOP USA is a marketing device. They were not affiliated with any party. So then I called the Republican National Committee, and they verified that this group was not affiliated with them. And so I resumed calling on him. That's where I would draw the line. The problem you get, Terry, is in this modern age where you've got bloggers and you've got talk radio of both the left and the right, who in the government should determine whether or not somebody is, quote-unquote, a reporter? If Al Franken were to show up in that room from liberal talk radio, do I have a right to bar him because he's a liberal? Or if he showed up in the Clinton administration, would reporters say he's asking softball questions? You should not allow him in the room? This is the problem that you've got in this modern age. What's a blogger? What's a reporter? As for his private life, I would fear the day if ever the government, outside the Secret Service for security purposes, but the government started looking into the private lives of reporters. If somebody has questions in their private life like he surely does, the news organization should be responsible for making a determination about whether that person should be employed or not. And I have a lot of faith that anybody with his background who worked in a mainstream outlet would no longer work there. But the government shouldn't make that call. The news organization should.
In terms of like who gets, you know, passes to the White House, who gets credentialed to be right. in the White House and who doesn't. Maureen Dowd in a column, and she used to be a White House reporter, and
correct.
Now she's a columnist, a liberal columnist. But she said that it took her a long time to get credentialed to go to White House briefing, and that it wasn't easy. She was denied at first. So,
well, she had a hard pass, and for a hard pass, you undergo a thorough background check by the Secret Service.
Mm-hmm.
And they look into your history and your background, et cetera. The day pass, they don't go through that type of review, which is probably why this James Gannon guy, why he didn't want to go for a hard pass. He knew his history would come out. So there are reporters you can show up on that basis. But the issue still becomes, should he have gotten a day pass to begin with? And as press secretary, I never got into those issues. There are some 2,500 credentialed reporters, and the last thing I wanted to do was deal with any of that, where you have to deal with it when it rises up to become a problem, and then you have to focus on it. The White House Correspondents Association looked at this whole issue in the wake of this little scandal, and they determined that no changes should be made in the White House policy. They think this is an isolated case, and I agree with that. I think this is odd. It is bizarre. I think it's also isolated. And why it would be a lot easier for the press secretary if a lot of these left-wing and right-wing fringes were removed from the room and the room was just really your mainstream press. It might be easier for me because I deal with less wacky questions, but I don't think it's right. I think you have to be prepared to deal with whatever is thrown at you in that room. And I would err on the side of being more inclusive about who's defined as a reporter, because I really fear that you chop off some bona fide reporting, even if it's at the fringe. Now, that might not be the case with this guy, but I think this guy's the exception to everything that happened, and people shouldn't change longstanding traditions of the White House, where that room has always been home to a lot of colorful characters on the left and the right.
A quote from Joe Lockhart, who was press secretary on President Clinton. To obtain a day pass during the Clinton administration, a reporter, quote, had to make the case as to why that day was unique and why he had to cover the White House from inside the gates instead of outside. Quote from Bruce Bartlett, who worked with the first President Bush and the Reagan administrations. Quote, if Gannon was using an alias, the White House staff had to be involved in maintaining his cover. Otherwise, it would have been a security breach.
When he would show up for the security check at the gate and have to give his name, then he had to use his bona fide name. Otherwise, Secret Service wouldn't have had any records for him. Then he came into the room, and I always knew him as Jeff Gannon. I never knew that he had a different name. Now, maybe there was somebody who worked for me who knew it, but I wouldn't have known that.
So do you think there was any security breach here?
No, I don't, because he walks through the same metal detector the same search procedures as everybody who has a hard pass.
Do you think that there was somebody on the inside who was kind of working things for him?
No. I think the real question is, was he a plant? And the answer to that is emphatically no. And even the White House correspondents who were in that room, who really never liked him, they've all said he's not a plant. But this is what happens in politics today. The left sees it, particularly coupled with the Armstrong-Williams episode, and they start to think and fear the worst. In fact, I think that's a grassy knoll on the left. The right has its own grassy knolls. We did a lot of that to Bill Clinton and to his associates. But absolutely not. Was he a plant?
So how do you like life outside of the White House now?
Well, I love it. I loved what I did at the White House, but I really enjoy now being in the private sector. My wife and I have a 10-month-old daughter, and we've moved to New York. And it's just a different world. I still enjoy politics. I still follow it, but I follow it from the private sector now.
Do you watch the White House briefings every day?
You know, I read them every day, but I think I've only watched one or two of Scott's briefings, but I read his briefings every day.
Not your favorite television show?
Well, I remember the day after I left the White House, I was on a treadmill working out in the middle of the afternoon, getting back into shape, and Scott's briefing came on TV, and my first reaction was, "Whoa, I wouldn't want to be in that guy's shoes."
Ari Fleischer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Ari Fleischer served as press secretary for President Bush from 2001 to 2003. He now has his own public relations firm. His new memoir is called Taking Heat.